My name is Rose Courteau. Today is May 30th, 2026. I'm here at the Hudson Public Library in Hudson, New York, with Kara Desideria. Mm-hmm. We met a few minutes ago after corresponding over email briefly, and Kara has agreed to contribute her voice to the archive that the Oral History Summer School keeps, the Community Library of Voice and Sound. Kara, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Kara Desiderio. I'm very happy to be here today. I'm a big fan of oral history and this project in particular, and I just care deeply about this area. I'm from Taconic and live in Taconic now, and I'm just so glad that there's an archive of stories being built in our community.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Kara, will you tell me a little bit about your early life?
My early life, I want to say took place here, in the larger sense of here, but I feel like oftentimes when people ask me where I'm from, well, we're here, I say I'm from here. I grew up in the town of Taconic, which is where I live now. I live across the road from the house that I grew up in my what was my grandfather's house. And I can't say that I loved growing up here. I have a lot of mixed feelings. I feel like this area contains multitudes, but there was just a lot of things that felt challenging to be in a small town, to live rurally. There are things that I really yearned and desired and wanted that just weren't reachable, especially here in the 80s and 90s, because it was just a quieter town than it is today, much quieter. And I really just wanted more culture and art and music and dance. And not to say that I didn't have those things in my life, but I think if I lived in a place where I could just dip into all of that, I just would have been in it all the time. Back in the 80s and 90s, this area just felt so far from New York City. There really wasn't a connection. Maybe for very upper class folks or people that had weekend homes up here or the celebrities that had estates up here. But for me, I just felt like it couldn't have felt further away. Wish that I felt more connection to that. I feel when I think about my childhood here, I think about how quiet it was. It was just a really quiet country existence, which in some ways I cherish, in some ways, like I said, drove me a little like I just wanted more. I'll share that my great grandfather, and to kind of just zooming out to like a larger perspective of my lineage to this place, my great grandparents were from Baldwin, Long Island, and they ran a excavation company, a horse powered excavation company. In Baldwin, Long Island, and during the Great Depression, their business went under. And they needed to find some money for their family. They had three boys, one of which was my grandfather, and they had cousins who were farmhands at a farm in Taconic. And they were able to get some work at this cousin's farm. This farm is at the end of Nostrand Road, which is off of Post Hill Road, which is a road that connects East Taconic to West Taconic and crosses over the Taconic State Parkway. So my great-grandparents moved there to a shack on a hill above the farm and raised their three kids. And my grandfather has all sorts of stories about walking to school. He went to a schoolhouse on Liss Bypass, which is a small road off the Beauty Award, which is what locals call this road called Route 11 that connects Taconic to Craryville. And in 1969, it won the National Beauty Award Highway, and so everybody calls it the Beauty Award. And so he would walk there to school every day and back, and eventually he went to Rojan, and he didn't graduate because they had a program where they were enlisting folks early into the services for World War II. So he left high school and didn't graduate. They gave him an honorary degree when he was in his 70s or 80s. So he, you know, was a real country kid, and especially the way that he grew up, just really in the elements and farming and in a house with very thin walls and walking to school and back. He just was a real country guy. And, you know, after he came back from the services, from World War II, there was an economic recession. There was no work up here. He came back to his family farm. There was nothing. He couldn't find work, so he wound up moving to the city. And he, you know, was always just a country guy at heart. But he had two kids in the city. Met my grandmother, who's an Italian immigrant. And they had two kids, one of which was my father, and raised him in Brooklyn. My parents, my mom met my dad, my dad met my mom, who was also raised by immigrants in Brooklyn, both of them having a very first-generation Brooklyn experience, and they decided to move up to the country to have me. So they just didn't like the city. They felt like it was a difficult place to be raised in the 60s and 70s. So I feel almost, I'm explaining all this because I feel like there is a way in which there are strong country roots in my lineage and there are strong city roots in my lineage. And I always felt like I just should have skipped a generation or something. That I was like, why am I the one being raised in the country? Like, my parents were raised in the city and all my family's back in the city and all of my, you know, Italian family and my mother's family, which is from Germany and Latvia. They're all in the city. I'm like, why are we up here with the crickets and the frogs? And I just, you know, so that was always a something that I held as a kid.
How did you create ways to expand your horizons?
Goodness. Well, I think that, I mean, being a kid of the 90s, I had a lot of independence, and I was just a very adventurous kid. I mean, even by the time I was in high school here, I was barely living at home. I was always at other people's houses and just like kind of just bouncing around a lot into different people's experiences and what was going on in their life and their homes. I do remember that when I was in high school and I went to Taconic Hills from kindergarten through 12th grade, and this was in the mid to late 90s, I was diagnosed with Lyme disease. And back then, nobody knew what Lyme was. It certainly was not the endemic that it is now. So I was, you know, traveling to see providers that were down in Old Lyme, Connecticut, and in Westchester, and nobody knew how to treat this. And all that's to say is that it really kind of just changed my life, because I had a lot of energy prior to that, and I was doing a lot of things. And then all of a sudden, I just felt like I had no energy, and I still had this, like, young teenage brain where I was like, what's, you know, not a lot of self-reflection and wondering what's happening to my body. So I was working, I was like waitressing and doing odd jobs here for money in high school. And then I needed to, like, being on my feet and waitressing was just becoming a lot. And I wound up doing IV antibiotics for Lyme. So I had a PIC line, and then I had a port at some point, and I had to do three bags of antibiotics a day for a time in my life as a high schooler. And I just was like, I need a job where I can sit down. So I made some, I had this idea. I made these business cards that said that I was a shop, that I'll be a shop sitter. I printed them on Print Shop and cut them out and walked up and down Warren Street and just handed out. And, you know, by the mid-90s to late-90s, all these antique shops were opening on Warren Street. And to locals, it was just like a joke. Like, what is this ridiculous? You know, they're selling this old rusty anchor for $5,000. You know, it was just obscene, this antique scene. But I was very interested in it because I really wanted to know why people would pay $5,000 for a rusty anchor, or just, you know, like, what is the beauty in this and what is the value in this? And I was very interested in that. So I was interested, and I thought this would be a job where I could sit down, where I could, you know, make money. They have money. They could pay me, you know, $10 an hour, which I thought at the time was good money. It was. So I wound up working for a bunch of different antique shops and art galleries up and down Warren Street. And I met so many people that I would have never crossed paths with in life if it weren't for that tiny industry. I mean, those antique shops were all tax shelters, essentially, to their businesses in New York City, or maybe even just room to store things. So they really didn't do a lot of business, per se. I think I probably did that for a year. And in the year that I worked at all these different galleries and shops, I only sold one thing the whole time. One, because there was just nobody in Hudson ever. Even on the weekends, sometimes one or two people would come into the shop. But there just was not, Hudson was not on the map like it is now. There was just very few people coming up. And when I did sell something, I remember that I had to, first I had to take their credit card, and it was the old machines that you had to, like, copy, make a, like, a carbon copy of the credit card. I was so nervous to do that. I was like, okay, making the carbon copy, and I forgot to charge them tax. And the owners of the store were so up there, like, you know, you sold this expensive thing. You didn't charge them tax. And I was like, oh, my God. I just wasn't prepared to actually ever make a sale at these stores because I did. There just really wasn't what they were about, it seemed. It seemed like they're more like people come and look at the things. And they did a lot of trading amongst each other and going to antique fairs and doing trading there. But as a store, I think a store was a strong word for what they were. But I share that because I think that meeting these folks and just kind of understanding the art world in which they came from, what they saw as beautiful. A family that I worked for owned an old farmhouse in Claverick that they didn't put any work into. It was just a very bare bones, minimal farmhouse. And in my little brain, my little Columbia County brain, I was like, why are these people not fixing up this house? Like, why do they just want to leave it like this? But I think, you know, I started to understand, like, the beauty in just country, you know, just like, or the beauty in just its original form. And yeah, that was a big, and even the people I met, I worked for a shop owner that, you know, gave me the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which I was absolutely thrilled to learn about and to read. There are just so many things that experience kind of unlocked for me, and I was just so hungry for it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your family?
Yeah. I'm an only child. My parents both worked for public schools here in the area. Like I had said, my parents grew up in these kind of immigrant enclaves in South Brooklyn and didn't love it, and made the very bold decision, I think, to move upstate. They built a house about less than a mile, probably, the way the crow flies, from the family farm at the end of Nostrand Road. At that point, we didn't own the farm anymore. It had been sold off. But, you know, my Italian family is very tight-knit. My grandmother was one of nine brothers and sisters, and they were all very close. And the family motto is that you don't have friends, you only have family. That's it. You're not allowed to have friends. Everybody lived within a few blocks from each other, and that was the way my dad was raised, and to some extent the way my mother was raised too. So the fact that they moved up here, I thought, was a very brave decision. And they loved it. They loved the fresh air and being in the country and projects. And my dad was a salesman for a time. He sold electrical parts, worked for a bunch of businesses in Hudson. My mother did as well. My mother worked as a secretary to an accountant that was on Warren Street. They both worked at CoArc for a little bit. And then my mother got a job at Taconic Hills as an administrator and worked there for 35 years in a bunch of different capacities. And my dad wound up going to school. He got his bachelor's degree when I was in middle school. And then wound up working for school districts as well as a guidance counselor. And we're a real tight-knit family, as is our family culture. Very loving. I think any time that my mother hears that I didn't love growing up here, she just cringes and she's like, oh, what did I do wrong? It's all my fault. And I'm like, it's not your fault. I really, you know, we were tight and loving, and I had a beautiful childhood in many ways. I learned how to swim at Oakdale. I did all the summer reading programs through the Hudson Library. There is a lot of, it was a great childhood in many ways.
So what does home mean to you?
I think a home is a sense of knowing in many ways. You know, I have two young kids now, school-age kids, that I'm raising here, and that this is their home too. I honestly can't believe that I live back here. Anyway, I just can't. I just never saw myself living back here. And when I left, I was very just, get me out. Like, I just felt very stifled by the small town. Everybody knows everybody. And just the parochial nature of small town living. Like, I just felt like, ugh, with homophobia and racism, I just wanted out of it. My kids now are growing up in a very different culture that I grew up here in. And it's wild to witness their journey. Even though I live across the road from the house that I grew up in, our life is so different than the life that I had growing up. I will share a story about home that really hit home for me. I had my first kid at home. She was a home birth, and it was a very difficult birth, unfortunately. And I had labored for many hours and was an active laborer, pushing for 5+ hours. It was too much to handle in a home setting. I did give birth to her, and then afterwards I had a postpartum hemorrhage at home, and they couldn't stop the bleeding, and I was very out of it during this time, but I think that I had pushed so hard and for so long that there was nothing that could contract my uterus again to stop that bleeding from happening. And so my midwife had made the decision to call the EMTs and take me to the ER because I was just really on the brink of losing consciousness. And I was kind of in and out of consciousness during this time. And I gave birth to Olympia, my daughter, in what was my grandfather's bedroom. And I'm just very aware of that. Like, this is a family home and this is family land, and I'm here at this time. This really exceptional thing is happening to me. And the EMTs came in and they all smelled like cigarette smoke, and they didn't really care that I just gave birth. They're just doing their job. Not to say that they weren't very nice. They were very nice, but I was like, oh, okay, this is happening. And they carried me out on a stretcher and put me in the ambulance. And I just, like, went into this other state in which I knew that I was traveling from my home to the hospital in Hudson, and I just knew every turn in the road. My partner Christina was sitting in the front seat with the driver, and she was like, we're at the stop sign in Churchtown. And I was like, I don't know if I said this out loud, but in my head I was like, I know exactly where we are. I'm barely conscious. I don't know what's happening to me right now, but I know where I am. Like, I just know. And I just could feel every turn of that ambulance until we pulled into the bay. And Christina kept telling me, you know, oh, now we're here, now we're here. And I was like, I just know. And I think that, to me, was like, I'm home. I just know this place. Like, it is a part of me.
Thank you for sharing that. You said you can't believe you're back. Where did you go?
Well, like my high school history teacher told me, all good girls from New York go to college in Massachusetts. So I went to college in Massachusetts. I actually first went to school in Virginia, and I left my freshman year and then transferred to Massachusetts, to UMass. And then after that, at that time, I got a degree in music, and I was a formal music major throughout my college years, and then I, at the end, switched to ethnomusicology, because I just felt, you know, so kind of my endless desire and I felt music was so narrow, and I wanted to learn more about different kinds of music and music theory from different cultures and countries. And so I graduated with a degree in ethnomusicology. And then at the same time in college, I was working for kind of worker co-ops and student-led businesses. And I was very involved in the worker co-ops on campus, and I wound up getting a internship in Berkeley, California, to work at a housing co-op there. So I moved out to the Bay Area, and then I lived in California for 10 years. I wound up working at a housing co-op in Isla Vista, which is the tiny little town around University of California, Santa Barbara. And then after that, I moved back up to San Francisco. And in between then, I did a lot of traveling, and I lived in West Africa for a summer, and I studied in Cuba for a bit, and I just did a lot of traveling, with my home base mostly being in California. And then when I was in San Francisco, I started making moves toward working in healthcare, which is what I do now. I'm a nurse practitioner. So at the time, I started working at a queer health clinic, mostly to see if I could handle the blood and guts. I was interested in healthcare, but I didn't know if I could really handle the on-the-ground healthcare. And I could. So I... worked at that clinic for years, and I helped start a transgender health access program from that clinic. And I met my partner, who is from San Francisco, and I really want to come back to New York, and I was going to go to nursing school, and I said, I really want to do that on the East Coast. I just felt this pull to come back to New York. And I love California, and it's still a huge part of me. But it's just, you know, I think when you're a New Yorker, you're a New Yorker, and you're just a New Yorker. And I really missed New York in every way. But I had to, I think, have some identity shifts in many ways. I think queerness kind of opens the door to thinking about identity more deeply and understanding yourself and kind of finding liberation through that in so many ways. Right before I moved back, I changed my last name from Nostrand, which is my family's name and my great-grandparents' name, my grandfather and my father's name, to Desiderio, which is my Italian family's name. And in some ways, that really unlocked me to like be able to come back, and especially to come back here, to feel like I was a bit of a new person. Or not a new person, but just a person who has grown and lived and changed and then wound up coming back here. I did go to nursing school at NYU down in the city, and my partner and I were actually coming up here a lot on the weekends, and she loved it up here. And I was like, yeah, it's all right. I was like, you know, it's pretty, I guess. But she just loved it. And I started to really, I think in order to consider moving back here, which is what we were doing when I got pregnant, is I thought, how am I going to have a baby in the city? I'm going to have to get a nanny. Where are we getting this money from? I don't, you know, we both have to work full time. It just felt like logistically so challenging. And I thought, I don't know, you know, I just wanted to, I felt like it would be nice to move upstate, but I kind of needed to see this area through somebody else's eyes, I think. And my partner really just showed me that. She's like, can't you see that we're swimming in this waterfall right now and it's so beautiful? And I was like, yeah, it is beautiful. So I think I kind of fell in love with it again when we moved back about 10 years ago, 11 years ago now. And it was it's a very different place, like I said, than it was when I was younger. There's fancy coffee and, you know, fancy restaurants, and there's queers living here, which I think most people that were wanting to do something different or do something out of the norm needed to leave here in order to do that when I was younger. That there's a strong cultural vibe back then that if you were, you know, different, then that was unacceptable, you know. Like, difference was fear. And there's not that now. There's just so much embracing of that, at least in some of the newer culture that's here.
How is your experience of the Hudson area, your early experience, how is that shaping the way you're parenting your children?
I think I feel like I'm a person that has one foot as a local and one foot as a non-local, whatever that term is. People around here say city people or whatever. I just feel like I am both. And I think that I am very intentional to give my kids experiences that I wanted as a kid. And it's not just city experiences. I mean, we do go down to the city a lot. Just to take them down to go to the Met or the Natural History Museum or to just see things that I wanted to do when I was a kid and just didn't really have access to culturally. But I think also just as like kind of the beauty of nature. Like we, go look for tadpoles in the pond and just kind of have these beautiful rolling summer country evenings or go snowshoeing in the woods or skiing or snowboarding at Catamount. Things that, like, I loved as a kid. And I think I love them more looking back at them. When I was little, I was like, okay, this is just life. But I was like, this is actually really cool and beautiful to experience nature and be close to nature. And like, we have chickens. My parents were from Brooklyn. They would have never had chickens. As my grandfather probably would have, but my parents would have never had chickens growing up. So we do things now that I'm like, that's a fun thing to do. And in some ways they do, you know, they participate in all the library programming the same that I did when I was young. And in some ways there's things that they don't do that I did. They don't go to Taconic Hills. I send them right now to a Montessori school. There's just community that I don't know. I just don't know how to be in, I guess, as a person that is, I don't know, just different than when I was when I grew up. So there's some things that are the same, and there's some things that are different, but I feel like I'm trying to instill the best for them. And they absolutely love it here, which really warms my heart.
You mentioned that there are some communities that you don't know how to be in. Is that a correct paraphrase?
Yeah.
Would you mind expounding on that? Is that something that you can talk to?
I think so. I think also, you know, politics play a part in it. And I think, you know, when we moved back, it was pre-Trump. And I felt a little bit more like connecting to some of my, like, you know, quote, redneck roots of, you know, gun culture and farming culture and things that I'm like, you know, we don't need to be so precious about these things. And I think that the world has changed so much in the last 10 years that I don't feel that way anymore. And it just, I feel a little bit more hesitant to step into conservative white culture around here, even though that's where I came from. My family was not conservative, but the predominant culture here was and especially within the Taconic Hills School District, was conservative. And it just makes it harder, I think. It's not that I don't have a lot of love for the community that I grew up in, and I see many of them often. And not that they're all even conservative still, but there's just, I think that liberation and moving toward good in the world is so central to me, and it's just tough to kind of bridge that.
What are some ways that you are trying to move toward goodness in the world?
I really try to just be a good neighbor and show up for people and care and put myself in other people's shoes. I think there's, I don't know, I've always been a hippie. I think that my kids just asked me the other day, they're like, "Are you a hippie?" I'm like, "Yeah, hell yeah." In high school, I was like, you know, a real deadhead, and I made my own clothes, and I traveled to all these shows. What I loved about going to these shows and kind of this counterculture was that they're like creating these communities that are in some ways, you know, like you're trading things, or it just was like a way where like love was very central. And so were drugs, and so were a whole bunch of other crap. But like just this idea of like, you know, utopian communities, or where people just lived in a way that was lifting each other up and not an extractive way and not a, you know, but in true community. I just really love that. And I still love that to this day. And I just try to show up for good in the world. And
can you talk a little bit about your years working in housing co-ops?
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah, so I got that internship in Berkeley at the Berkeley Student Co-op, which is a network of housing co-ops around UC Berkeley. Some houses you didn't need to be a student to live in, and some of them you did because they were just properties leased from UC ownership. But when I arrived in Berkeley, I felt like I had arrived. I mean, talk about my hippie roots being realized. I just felt like this is it. This is like, you know, I'm doing Food Not Bombs in the park on the weekend and just like talking to people. And I, you know, all of my clothing were from Free Piles. And when I got this job as an intern at the housing co-op, they gave me a room to live in. They were like, what house do you want to live in? And I looked at all the different cultures of all the different housing co-ops. There's a vegetarian house, which I've been a vegetarian, so it's like maybe I'll live in the vegetarian house. There's a queer house. There was, you know, all sorts of different, like, kind of themed houses. But there's this one house called Chateau, which was actually three different Victorians in a lot together, Les Chateaux, that really called to me, and it was absolute like hedonism. It was like punk culture, street culture. The entire house was graffitied from like my friend from here picked me up at the airport in Oakland because she was living out in California at the time. She grew up a half a mile down the road from me. We were childhood friends, and she dropped me off at this house and she's like, are you going to be okay? And I just looked at her and I was like, yes, I'm going to be okay. I'm so happy right now. And everything was cooperative about the house. The governance of the house just kind of made it that we all made decisions together. There were no plates. There were no forks. You had to like eat off the back of a Frisbee. We had to order like bulk food that was in a walk-in fridge that, you know, it was just like, it was not only like kind of cooperative structure and living, but it was like making room for every weirdo under the sun. And there were people that were definitely many were active drug users. Lots of folks that were just homeless youth would live or crash in the house on the front porch or in the living room downstairs. And some people get really pissed about that, and some people wouldn't. We'd have long house meetings about it. So I found that sort of like experimental living to be incredible and a real formative time in my life. And then I wound up from there getting a job as the director of a housing co-op in Isla Vista. And I don't, you know, sometime I'm like, I was 23 years old and the executive director of a nonprofit. Like, what, how could that be? I knew not what I was doing, but I was very dedicated to learning. And, I think your home is so much more than a roof over your head. And I think when I, you know, would sit through hours of different people's house meetings, including my own and other, you know, you can just see how important home is, how people need to feel in their homes, how people need to feel respected, or, you know, how people like their space. And that kind of process of working that out with other people, I just found enthralling. So, yeah, that kind of world has a deep place in my heart, and I think that there's so many there's so many good things that can come from living communally. I know it's not for everybody, but I always actually imagined that I'd live communally as an adult in like a shared family situation. And I don't, however, I would. And also I live on the same land as my parents. So we all, you know, we live on 50 acres in Taconic, and their house is on one end and my house is on the other. One of my best friend's parents, my best friend from San Francisco, her parents bought my childhood home across the road. So we do have a communal living situation in a larger sense, I feel. I love that. I think it's kind of building love and community and family around you, wherever you go.
Let me restart. You have mentioned that Hudson has changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What are the primary challenges you see in Hudson right now, facing residents here?
Hmm. I think Hudson is such an interesting example of a small town with a lot of diversity. And I mean racial diversity and also class diversity. And I really see that Hudson has two economies, and I don't know really where they meet. Maybe at the public school, but I mean, you could just see like the economy of Warren Street is very different than the economy of Columbia Street or Front Street. And I mean, as gentrification just continues to kind of snowball here, there is an erasure of that. But I think in the last 10 years, I've seen, when I first moved here, I was like, there are so many youth in this city that need a job. And are they finding jobs on Warren Street? No. But now I do feel like they are. I do feel like there's more of a, like an effort, like an actual, like a community care to kind of bridge these two worlds. And, you know, I mean, I speak deeply from my experience, too, which was, you know, I mean, when I was working on Warren Street at those shops, it was so bougie. It was just it was a bouge fest in every way. And, you know, the only CDs to play in the shop were like opera or Talking Heads, which I had never heard of before. Like, you know, I was like, okay. And then I'd leave work and I'd close up the shop and I'd go get a sub. There was a deli on the corner of 3rd and State called Nazma Deli. It's no longer called Nazma. It just closed not long ago. Still a deli though, but they had a $5 deal of a 6-inch sub, chips and a Coke. And I'd go get that at Nazma Deli, and I'd go down to the boat launch because we didn't have the waterfront back then, the waterfront park. So I'd go down to the boat launch. I'd go get some very terrible weed from my boyfriend's stepmom who ran the taxi company next to Half Moon. She was a dispatcher at the taxi company. It was horrible weed. It was all seeds and stems. And we'd sit at the boat launch and eat food and smoke a joint and then go hang out with friends at the terrace apartments at the low rises. I had friends that like, you know, or had kids as teenagers. And just needed help, just hands on deck for raising kids and babies. And I just thought, how wild that I go from like this world of selling something for ridiculous amounts of money, that something costs so much in these stores. I could never imagine ever having enough money or ever desiring to buy something that costs that much money, to like, you know, what my experience was, which was like getting some food and smoking a joint and being down at the river and hanging out with people. And in some ways, those two worlds just exist here. And I do think they overlap sometimes, but I'm not quite sure if the other can really see each other sometimes. I don't know.
Are there any challenges that you think could be meaningfully addressed through conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I do even think all of the oral history pieces that have been done throughout the years here have been just amazing. I've listened to so many of them. I don't know if others do, but I love to listen to people's stories. And I think that, you know, I truly believe that people's stories are what changes hearts and minds. And it reminds me of, you know, running this transgender health program in San Francisco and at the very beginnings of trans messaging and trying to get people to understand identity in this way. One of the easiest ways was if you heard somebody's story. If somebody just sat with you and told you their story, and you could connect with pieces of that story, and you could understand that story, I think there's so much power in that. And I see that happening for sure. And I'm sure that, you know, social media is a catalyst of that too here locally. And it's also, I mean, social media here is also very divisive and can also harm community. But there's ways in which you can see your neighbors and really see your neighbors in ways that you may not have before. I think there's just a lot of good that can come from continuing those having those conversations and sharing those stories. As messy as they are, I feel like my story is messy in many ways, and I feel a lot of feelings about it. Like it's not easy to share all of your feelings when you don't have a keen analysis on them, or they aren't tied up in the perfect way. But I think it's okay to kind of hold each other in the mess. And I think that's kind of the only way that people can kind of come together in community is if you do that. Just be vulnerable and respectful with each other.
You said your story is messy. How do you mean?
It's just a feeling, really. I think that, to me, I feel as though I have lived many lives. I've touched on probably just a few here, sitting here today. I'm not quite sure. I'm just always kind of threading the needle through all of these lives of mine. And sometimes when I run into somebody that I haven't seen since high school, I'm just like, you know, you just know this one version of me that was, you know, a hot mess of a teenager or something. And I've always just been very confidently myself. And then, of course, you know, you look back and you're like, oh, my God, I didn't know who I was then, or I was just a different person then. So, yeah, I just feel like a lot of the work that I try just to do for myself is just weaving all of these different lives together and making sense of them. But I think that there is also a fear that I have that comes from probably my family culture in general, but I think also very much growing up in a small town and a town where everybody knows everybody and everybody is related to everybody, and there is truth in that, that I am scared to be seen, you know, that I just, you don't, there's just, there's that judging, that small town judging eye. I want nothing to do with it. I just want to be away from it. So I think that's a part of just why I think it can feel a little messy. And I think someday I'll pull all these threads together, but it's a work in progress.
You said you've only shared a few of the many lives you've led. I'm paraphrasing. Is there another life that you would like to share within this session?
Oh, I've shared so many. I don't think so, no. I don't think so. Maybe someday. But yeah, I think I'm still like building some courage in some ways to show up in my full self. And, you know, for years, and, you know, I'm also a healthcare provider, and I see, you know, so I see people in the community, and I have a professional relationship with people. For many years before I was an NP, I was a school nurse. So for me, I think, you know, even the idea of talking about smoking a joint down by the river, which I think is a shared experience of every person in Columbia County, just saying that out loud, I'm like, okay, I just, you know, I want to, yeah. I think I'm a very adventurous person. I've done a lot of things. Even part of my name change from Nostrand to Desiderio. Desiderio in Italian means desire. And I just thought there could be no perfect family name for me than one that means desire. And that I'm just, I kind of lead with that. And that leads me to many different places. Yeah.
Would you like to share a little bit more about the transgender health initiative that you launched when you were in California?
Yeah. At the time, I was working at Lion Martin Health Services, which is still there today. They had kind of changed a bit and lost their independence and then came back into being a fully independent clinic. So I'm so happy that they are still a queer clinic still in San Francisco. They're named after Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, which were kind of pioneering lesbians in the 50s and 60s. And I, at Lyon Martin, I was working as a phlebotomist and a medical assistant. And then I started running their volunteer program. And then there became a grant opportunity that was available that the director at the time was like, are you interested in working with this and helping me launch this idea that we have? And it was pretty incredible. We applied for a Robert Wood Johnson grant that was a matching grant that was really a program. We built a program that was around the medical and legal needs of transgender people. So it was around improving healthcare access and also legal access because the two go hand in hand for trans folks often. So we started working with the Transgender Law Center with that project, and we did that through a variety of ways. We had a student rotation that came to the clinic for med students that was just for transgender health. that they could just work in gender-affirming healthcare and work with hormones and understand medical transition. We went around to clinics throughout California and trained their staff on trans competency, like from waiting room to rooming to the providers. We also did a lot of policy advocacy. So we worked in town, in small towns or counties around to help them get gender identity and expression added as protected non-discrimination clauses, just kind of working on the policy angle. The work we did was incredible and felt really like this was, you know, the late, like 2007 to 2012. I always like to say this is pre-Laverne Cox, before like she was on the cover of Time magazine. This was like really, I felt like we were doing incredible, important work. And it has been absolutely devastating to watch so much of that be rolled back in the last so many years. But yeah, that work still lives in me, and I still do gender-affirming healthcare now as a nurse practitioner, and my practice is very queer-centered.
Our interview is coming to an end soon, and I'm wondering if there are some things that you would like to talk about that we didn't get to.
I don't think so. I don't know if I've ever talked about myself this long. So I feel like I've covered a lot of ground here. I appreciate the space for it not to be a polished story and to just be what it is, kind of in just in real time and in real life.
So your chosen last name means desire.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share something you're desiring going into the future?
Think that I'm really desiring to, I mean, we've been talking about it in so many ways, but, you know, I keep thinking about it this week because there's kind of a crisis situation happening at my kid's school right now where a lot of parents are coming together to talk about it, and everybody has a lot of feelings because it has to do with our kids. It's almost reminding me of COVID times, you know, where things are personal, you know, and we have to talk about these really hard things because they're personal to us and they matter. And I think over these last years that we've lived through, I think we're being called to speak our truth, and to not be as much as, you know, people-pleasing, or to not to just kind of, you know, say the messy thing and say it with love and say it in an imperfect way. And I want that more in the future. I want to feel like we can continue to share strong feelings and to be vocal about it, and to feel like we have the energy and the support to do that, to build things, to keep building things. I think right now there's such a nature of, like, you know, I just keep thinking of the word, like, catabolic, you know, like things are just blowing up and it just feels like we're losing rights and privileges and decorum and so many things. But I want, you know, I'm just desiring things to be built and to kind of come together, even though we're all like, what is happening? And we all feel a bit shook, that we can come together and continue to build good things, good community, and a good world for whatever comes after us.
Kara, thank you so much for letting me interview you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And we spoke about this a little bit off tape before we started recording, but I'm going to add a postscript introduction for myself for the archive. Again, my name is Rose Perteau. I'm 34 years old. I'm white. I grew up in Arkansas, and I've lived for most of my adult life in New York City. I'm a mother. I'm married to a man. And those are some things that I want recorded in the archive as your interviewer. Is there anything else you want to add as a postscript?
No.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.